Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, toughmantri.com, VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, ATVSwimSpas.com, the official training vessel for six-time Ironman World Champion Dave Scott, RunCatalina.com, the Catalina Eco Marathon Half Marathon 10K coming up Saturday, November 18th, DonateCAF.com, our Challenged Athletes Foundation. We just sent out 2,448 grants, totaling $3.7 million. Keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbittville.com, on iTunes, and as always, endurance lives here. Our next guest, he is the world champion for the first ever Challenge World Championship, just called the Championship, at Chamarine. I love that. Lionel Sanders joins us. How you doing, Lionel?
I'm good, Bob. How are you, man?
I am spectacular. So you have had, this year has been pretty special, especially some of the battles that you've had with Sebastian Keenley through this year. What have you learned about this guy through these battles you've had?
I mean, Keenley is such a great athlete. Every time I see him, every time I talk to him, I learn something. And we had that good battle in Chamarine, as you say.
Yes.
And it was you know, great battle, right? Probably about 15K we ran side by side. And at about, you know, how you always think at the end of these races, even though he was maybe 400 meters behind me, you still feel like he's breathing down your neck. And I was just going to fly through this sweet finish line they had, because I was so worried. He was so close. And he put his hand over the railing. There was like an out and back section. He put his hand over the railing at like maybe 20.2K. And basically, you know, I knew what that meant. I didn't need to do anything. We slapped five, and I knew it meant, you know, enjoy that finish line. I'm not pressing. Don't worry about it. And so just, you know, just one of those things that a true champion does. And so, you know, that was a lesson that I'll take into my, my, I guess, arsenal, and hopefully maybe one day I can do the same kind of thing to someone. So, I mean, great athlete. I love Sebastian.
Well, the other side of that is there's such a mutual respect there. When you look at that race, and I saw a soundbite from you after the race, like, listen, if I won this race or lost this race, I would feel just the same. This is what I want to be. I want to be tested by the best guys in the world. Today I was tested by the best guy in the world. I won, but even if I didn't win, I would have felt like this was still a victory.
Totally. I mean, I do this thing, of course, you know, getting a win and that stuff's all fine and dandy, and trying to make a living doing it, that's all cool and everything. But the fact of the matter is, what makes me train hard, and what, you know, why I go to these things is for that moment, for that test, when you're going basically head to head. And I don't think you can truly find out what you're capable of on your own. You need someone else who's a very similar ability, who's trained as hard, who's just as hungry. And you need someone like that to take you beyond what you think is possible. And that really is what was happening in that race. We swam side by side on the bike. We literally biked with each other the entire ride. And then we ran 15K. So we spent like something like 3 hours and 10 minutes together, you know, basically side by side. And, you know, bumping elbows. Neither of us would give each other an inch. He was trying to drop me over and over again. And quite frankly, he had broken me mentally. He showed no weakness whatsoever. He sounded great, great turnover. You know, he did these surges, never gave out any, like, didn't show any weakness. But then and this is the interesting part of when you're in a battle like that and have spent so much time with someone, is you really start to pick up on tiny, tiny little things. And we went through an aid station at about 11 kilometers, and for literally maybe five steps, he let out like these couple moans, like, ugh, ugh. And literally the tables turned right then and there. And I knew, okay, he's suffering just as much as I am. And the moment I realized that he was suffering as much as I am, I knew, okay, I still got a shot at winning this thing. And so then suddenly all the surges and everything were put into perspective. He was trying to get rid of me because,
right.
I mean, I think he didn't want to go toe to toe right to the final K. And so then I knew, okay, just weather the surges, and, you know, then he slows down again. And so once I got all that into my head, then all of a sudden I was able to, you know, my strength grew. And then I started to think, you know, another 3-4K down the road, I think, you know what, I think I'm going to win this thing. And then a gap opened up as we went through an aid station. I said, it's now or never. And I basically didn't. I didn't allow myself to look back. Fortunately, like maybe another 2K down the road, there was a turnaround, and I was able to get a little glimpse of him. And he was still only maybe 150 meters back, and just kept the pedal to the metal. And then I went to that turnaround that I said at about 20K, where he put his hand over the railing and gave me the slap five. And I mean, it was a great battle. Like one, you know, it truly, if I had finished second, it wouldn't have mattered. It was just a great battle from start to finish.
Well, and I think that goes back to that 2014 St. George, where you finished the race, you weren't happy, and you started questioning, gosh, am I in the right sport? Why am I doing this? And then I think you sort of had a talk with yourself and realized, you know what? I don't ever want to have that attitude again. My attitude needs to be, especially coming from where you came from, dealing with the drug addiction, dealing with the fact that you were really fairly new at this, that you needed to be grateful for what you had, grateful for the ability to use your body the way you're using it, and grateful for every result, no matter what it was.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't care if you're first or last place. Everyone should have the same perspective. It's 100% a privilege for everyone. And at any time, that can be taken away for you know, good or bad reasons. And so you should cherish every single race as if it's your last. And I mean, that sometimes it can be very difficult to do that, especially when the races go bad and or, you know, something goes wrong. But the fact of the matter is we're having, you know, I mean, we're playing sports and we're having fun and we're doing, you know, I mean, we're healthy, we're in sound mind. The rest of it's irrelevant. I mean, those are the real, true relevant things. And, you know, you do well, that's just icing on the cake.
So this year, when you talk about the great race with Sebi at the World Championships, you go into the season and you're all excited. You're going to be racing Oceanside against Jan Frodeno. That's the gold standard. Two-time Olympic gold medals from 2008, two-time Ironman world champion. You're itching to race this guy. Did a lot of training leading into it, ready to go head-to-head, and you're just about to catch him on the bike, and he flats. And
yeah.
and you were, I mean, a lot of people would be like, oh, this is great. My main competition's out of the race. But you were pissed.
Yeah, it was completely, I mean, I still wonder how the heck we got to the moon, and yet we're still getting flat tires. You know what I mean? In bike races, I just don't get it. I feel like the patents have all been bought up or something to keep the tire industry alive or something. But anyways, really, I'd say if I had to rank like my best races from a development standpoint, You already hit one of them. One was St. George 2014.
Yes.
And then another one was Oceanside 2015, where I came out of the water with a 4.5-minute deficit. Then I bridged the gap on the bike. And then Jan and I ran side by side for the first 5K. And then he basically dropped me, you know, like no problem. And there was no excuses, no nothing. He was stronger than me. But I tasted it for a second. We bumped shoulders, you know, handed me a cup of water. And it was like, that was when I really said, okay, you know, if you can continue to work hard, continue to improve, I think you can duke with this guy. And so basically the next 2 years, I literally have reflected on that experience over and over and over again. I mean, at one point I had my background on my computer was a picture of me and him side by side in that race.
Yeah.
And so I would say it's probably been one of the most motivational experiences I've ever had. And so 2017 Oceanside was supposed to be the rematch where I finally get to show I can compete too. I mean, in my head, I had planned that we were going to go 20K side by side and we're going to find out who's the better sprinter.
Right.
And so, and that's a perfect race. You know what I mean? Everybody wants to take part in that type of battle. And so, I mean, but then to have it, he is obviously in great shape, was in great shape, I was in great shape, and then, you know, it was unfolding exactly as I had hoped. I had the swim of my life, I was only 2.5 minutes down, and then I was at about 15 miles, I think I was about maybe 10 seconds down, I could see him, and then he pulls off to the side of the road, and puts his hand up and, you know what I mean, flat tire. And so it's just so lame. It's just such a lame way. It's not how I had seen.
No.
I never had mentally prepared for that to happen. And so it just deflated my entire race plan. And so it actually was the oddest experience I've had, because it was like I had no motivation anymore. Like, that was the motivation.
Sure.
To have that battle. But anyways, it's my job, so I had to figure it out and get my head back in the game. But yeah, I would much rather have stopped the race then and there and, you know, fix the tire, and then we assign whatever the gaps were and start the race again.
I love that. So the other thing that you do, which I love, is sometimes you look for races that don't really fit your comfort zone. Let me go down to Buenos Aires. It's a non-wetsuit swim in a lake. Lots of turns on the bike, because I'm really, most of my training's indoor, so I'm really good at just putting out wattage and going straight. And, you know, you go down there and you're, what, 3 minutes down out of the water and then take the lead at 35K. But you like that. You like the challenge of going a place where people don't think that it suits you, and then sort of proving to yourself that, you know what, everything suits me.
Well, it certainly is, now that I think I've got to a point in my career where I can make those kind of decisions. Like, in the beginning, I mean, if you go to a race like that and it doesn't suit you and then you do poorly, well, that's not going to be very good for sponsors and that sort of
thing.
So I feel like I've proven myself now, and my sponsors have sort of given me free rein on the season and what I want to do and what's going to be best for long-term development. And for me, I mean, the races around here anyway, they're pretty much always wetsuit legal. You know, very oftentimes they're in lakes, so there's no chop really.
Right.
And the bike courses are oftentimes just straight out and back down a highway, that kind of thing. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm at that point now where, you know, that's kind of old now. I know I can race well in those conditions. Now the next frontier is, can I race well in non-wetsuit? Can I race well in non-wetsuit ocean? That would be another thing I'll probably start seeking out next year. And then, of course, more technical bike courses. So 2016, I went and put myself into a very uncomfortable situation at V-Spot in 70.3 in Germany, which is, I mean, I didn't even realize how technical the bike course was, with descents and all of this sort of thing. And I literally felt like I was in fear for my life for three quarters of the bike ride. But it was a great experience. And then you come back to these, you know, like a St. George, which still has some half decent descents with, you know, a little bit of technical aspects to them, but nothing compared to, you know, some of these technical European courses. And then Buenos Aires, yeah, it was the same deal. It was a non-wetsuit. And then it was a three loop. I had never taken part in the three loop 70.3, and it was, you know, on a pretty, there was probably maybe three roundabouts, bunch of 90s, bunch of 180s on every single lap. So it was certainly not to my liking riding on the rollers or on the stationary trainer. So, but you know what I mean? Now when I go back to a, you know, a more, I guess, quote unquote, normal race, it's like significantly puts it into perspective. So it was a great experience. And in Buenos Aires, for instance, I was only 3 minutes down in a non-wetsuit lake swim, and
yep.
So usually I would have probably been 4 minutes down. So I remember when I got out of the water, I was like, I don't even need to finish this race now. Like, I've already come here, done exactly what I wanted to do. The rest is just for fun now. So it's fun when you have that perspective.
So when you were doing the World Championships in Chamonix, you're 3:15 down in the water to Richard Varga, who's one of the best guys. And leading into the race, your luggage doesn't show up. You're basically sitting around your room in, what, a double XL shirt. And you really, everything that could go wrong before the race, and this is a big race, it's a World Championship, the first one the Challenge has ever done, it would be easy to lose it. It'd be easy to go, oh, my God, all the other guys have their stuff and their training. And how did you keep it together knowing that, I'm not getting my stuff, my bike's not here, dealing with all of that?
I mean, I'd say the first thing that I consoled myself with is, you haven't been racing very long if you don't have a horrific travel story where your luggage didn't show and you missed all your flights and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, everyone has that story, and that's now my story. It just sucks because that race was from the get-go, when I found out at Island House, I found out Richard Murray was doing it. And like from basically day one of the season, that was to be my A race for the first half of the season. So it just sucks when that happens. But then the other piece of the puzzle comes in, which I really, this is sort of one of the things that you can't control, but always provides, I guess, growth opportunities, is when things go wrong. I mean, that's really what it is. You can panic and you can, you know, say and use it as an excuse and all that sort of stuff. Or you can look at it for what it really is, and it's an opportunity to become mentally stronger, to grow, to have a better perspective. And so, I mean, I would say I'm starting to get to the point where it doesn't matter what happens, the more adversity that occurs before the race, it's actually going to make me stronger, because it's more of an opportunity to prove that I can handle the adversity. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And so that's how I looked at it. And, you know, we tried to have some fun with it and laugh about it with our little dumb Instagram videos. Like, the airline gave me, literally, I had nothing, and the airline gave me a bag with a toothbrush, a double XL white T-shirt, and a comb, which is not really going to help me race or train or do much of anything. I guess I'll have, you know, clean teeth, but
yes,
that's about it.
I love that.
So, you know, we tried to make some humor out of it, and, I mean, everyone was really nice. Like, once again, just showing the great athlete in person Sebastian is, he sent me a message saying, I got my road bike here if you want to use it to go do some easy rides and stuff before in the days before the race and that sort of thing. And
what a class act.
Yeah, so everything was good. And challenge was great, too. Zibby said basically because my bike still hadn't arrived on, it was like dinner time on Thursday, the race is Saturday morning. And he was like, you know, tomorrow morning, if it's still not here, we'll sound the panic horn and we'll get you everything you need, bike, wetsuit, everything.
Yeah.
You'll have it. You'll be able to race. So I had all that, you know, in action if I needed it. But fortunately, the bike ended up arriving late Thursday night, and it all worked out all right.
So that also is an opportunity. And St. George, Alistair Brownlee, double gold medalist. Again, you know, we're sort of in this cool era where you got Jan Frodeno and Javier Gomez and Alistair Brownlee. A lot of the races you've done this year, you've gone against the best guys in the world, which is great. So Alistair comes to St. George and basically just is in another zone. But then you get a rematch, right, at the Chamarin. And you're only... You're, like you said, you're 315 down to Richard Varga, but you're only 230 down to Alistair Brownlee. You're swimming. What have you been doing swim-wise? Because obviously that same type of event a year ago, I think you would have been at least a minute further back.
Yeah, for certain. I would have been, I mean, in St. George, I was 315 or 313 down to Alistair.
Yeah.
And then yeah, I was 230 down in Chamarin. So I, without a doubt, if you had just plopped me into that same race 1 year earlier, I would have been 4 minutes down for sure.
Right.
And I would say probably the biggest things that I've started to do is I think I've reached a really good balance now. And this is true of my bike and my run training as well. I finally starting to be able to integrate the swimming into the bike run training so that I hit the key hard sessions and I'm not tired from the bike and run. But then when I am tired from the bike and run, instead of going out and trying to bang out these really hard sessions and probably failing and becoming, you know, ingraining bad technique and all this stuff because I'm tired, instead I go and I do an easy, very technical focused swim with maybe a few short reps and that sort of thing, just to make sure that kind of muscle, that firing pattern is still being worked. But I'm not, you know, trying to just grind away for just because you should or whatever, like I should be swimming 25K a week and I need to be swimming hard 5 of 7 days a week, all this kind of stuff. I've just completely done away with that sort of thing. And then another piece of the puzzle too is I don't think I'm overtraining on the bike and the run anymore nearly as much as I was in previous years. And due to that fact, I'm just not as tired, you know, in just general every day-to-day life, day-to-day training. And because I'm not tired, I then have more, I guess, you know, neurological awareness and that sort of thing to make changes and to hold good form and to just get the turnover over and all that sort of stuff. So I think you can never look at any one sport on its own. It always has to be looked at, you know, all three as a whole. And I think I'm just getting better at that. And I would say that's probably the biggest reason why I'm improving is just, you know, good conscious awareness inside of, you know, not that much fatigue.
So when you're doing Chamonix and you come off the bike, and you and Sebi have knocked off a lot of time from Alistair. You're what, 45 seconds down? Talk a little bit about, because you've been a big advocate for it, and I was in Dubai the first time they did a 20-meter draft zone at a challenge race, and it was a time trial, which is what it's supposed to be. And yeah. it was about the cleanest race I had ever seen, and the best person won. You knew the best person won. There was never any question. How nice was that for you to do a race where you knew, in your head, you not have to think, oh, my God, there's a group of 10 guys up there. And even if they're riding legally, they're still getting a huge advantage.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's the same theme. Like, I'm doing this not because I necessarily, I want to win, of course. But I'm doing it more because of, it's a test, it's a challenge. And I think that's why most guys are doing it, is for that reason. And, after many, many big races, it's the same complaints over and over again from particularly the male pro field. And I think as the women's pro field gets deeper and deeper, the same complaints will come about. But, 70.3 Worlds, for instance, you got literally a 20-man pack coming out together, riding bang on, maybe even a little less, because no one even really knows what 10 meters is. And, there's a study that just came out this week that shows a massive benefit at 10 meters.
Oh, yeah.
And it's all fine and dandy, I mean, but the reality is we all want it to be more of a individual test. If everyone wanted it to be that way, then it's all fine and dandy, but it's the same complaints after these races every single time. So to go to this race and to have challenge, I guess, implement this and make sure that when this race finishes, no one's going to be able to say, what if, what if it was more of an individual bike ride? What would have happened? And I think that's how all world championships should be, is the very best man wins. And not to say that the very best man hasn't been winning. It's just we want to get rid of the what if component. And going to the 20-meter draft zone, or even going to the staggered type rule, certainly gets rid of that what if. And in Samarin, there was no what ifs, It was a clean race, biking for their ability. And we saw, we saw what individual biking looks like. And you also see, interestingly, what running looks like after an individual bike ride. And that's a component that's very difficult to quantify in some of these big races where you have a 20-man pack. It's very difficult to say, well, if you were sitting 15 guys back, getting 100-watt less, pull, basically, of course your run legs are going to look phenomenal.
Yeah.
Had you had to do that exact same, another 100 watts to go that same speed, your run legs would have looked a lot different. And so it changes the whole game when you make the bike ride individual.
Well, it was fascinating to me is last year at Gold Coast, like you said, it was a group of 20, and then a lot of guys who aren't necessarily the strongest cyclists in the world were still there at the end of the bike ride. And so then everybody's running, 111, 112. And I know you were pushing, 330 watts? You were pushing a lot of watts during that bike ride.
I averaged 356 watts.
356.
To this day, my best bike ride.
Your best bike ride, 356, and made up like zero ground, right?
I got out-biked by 15 guys in that race, actually.
Yeah, exactly. And Sebi, who swam like a minute faster than you, was able to bridge and was able to be there, and I think he got second to Tim Reed at the end of the day.
Sure.
But it, after that race, when you started looking at the numbers, is that when you realized, okay, this world championship, 70.3 world championship, that's not going to make a lot of sense for me until I, one, can swim better, or I can, or they do a 20-meter draft rule.
Yeah, I mean, there's a component of that. There certainly is a component of that. I was devastated after that race. I mean, I entered a depression after that race for several weeks, and my whole family could see it, and I knew it. I was very conscious of it, and predominantly it was because I had never. Sport has always been, very positive. I don't have any negative experiences ever playing sports. I love sports. But that one experience, I just felt like it was unfair, I went to it in the absolute best shape of my life, and I can handle getting beat, not a problem. In fact, when I get beat, it's usually the best races.
Right.
They're the most growing experience. But I just felt like I had gotten beat by a lot of guys who we're getting a massive pull, and I just don't think it has to be that way. It you know what I mean? Challenge in this last race proved that it doesn't. It's not this big difficult thing to implement a 20-meter draft zone or a stagger rule to make sure we make the race as fair as possible. Because the fact of the matter is, this is literally our heart and soul on the line here. And of course, careers and paychecks and all that other stuff. But the heart and soul is the most important component. And you know what I mean? When a race is being, the outcome is being determined basically on the bike ride, it's lame, quite frankly. And it was just a very difficult experience for me to swallow. And so basically why I have decided not to do a 70.3 Worlds again for the indefinite future is because I can't do that to myself. You know what I mean? I can't go to a race and give myself to a race, and then something like that happens again, where I basically, just because I was, let's call it, a minute and a half off the pace on the swim, that my entire race is over. You know what I mean? It's if I wanted that style of racing, I would go do ITU, you
right.
know, draft legal racing. And the fact of the matter is, it's labeled as a non-drafting race. So it's very easy to make it a non-drafting race with a few slight changes in the rules. I mean, the fact of the matter is, we have changed the draft zone in the past as the sport evolved, and the sport has evolved even more. You know what I mean? It used to be 215 was a good 70.3 bike ride, 40 kilometers an hour. Now, I mean, if you're not riding under 205, you're not really riding. So we're riding, you know, 3-4 kilometers an hour faster, and yet the draft zone has stayed stagnant. The rules haven't evolved. Whereas you look at a sport like golf, which is, you know, older than the United States of America, and they're continuing to change the rules to update the game, to make it relevant and that sort of thing. And I think that's where we're at, you know what I mean, in this particular area. So that's what I'm a proponent for. And so, you know, for me, I've decided to just stay away from the 70.3 Worlds for a bit. And on the other hand, I can put my eggs in the Kona basket, and I think due to the fact that though Kona would be much better if it also implemented these rules, you know, due to the fact that it's a longer swim, significantly more difficult course and conditions in particular, with the wind and the sun and everything, it becomes a much more fair race, especially on the way home, the final 80 kilometers back into town.
So when you were in Chamonix, coming out of the water, I know there was a point you were swimming going, oh my God, I got to get to Sebi. And then you look over and see a number two on the swim cap and go, oh, I'm with Sebi. That had to be awesome.
Yeah, it was an interesting experience, because I thought I lined up right next to him, and I thought he had dropped me. And so, yeah, I was chanting, bridge the gap, bridge the gap, bridge the gap, because he was about 3 minutes ahead, or about 3 meters ahead of me. But then I'm swimming really hard, and then I look over the right, and he's actually like a foot behind me to the right. And so then I was like, oh, you're in the pack, like you've made it.
Right.
'Cause I'd never been that far, 300 meters or so into the race, and still been with Sebastian. So I knew right then and there it was going to be the best swim that I ever had. And what's interesting is, if I reflect back on all the swims, it was the easiest swim I've
yes.
had as well, because I was in the pack. And I've heard all these stories from the guys who have improved their swim, that it's like, you know, you're not really improving. You're swimming. Your deficits are the same. And then all of a sudden, one day you swim like a minute and a half faster because you made the pack.
Right.
And I mean, I'm used to swimming these things completely solo. And so the energy expenditure is probably significantly more when I'm swimming solo at, let's say, 120 per 100 versus swimming in the pack at 115 per 100. So, I mean, that's the name of the game, is getting that takeout speed and being able to hold on for the first 400 until the pace settles down. So that's another component that I'm definitely incorporating into my training.
So when you guys get off the bike and realize, well, one, you realize you're putting time into Alistair in the bike, and then you're only 45 seconds down. I think you caught him just, you caught him like 2K into the run.
Mm-hmm.
That had to be like, oh, my God, this is a double gold medalist, and I'm running by him.
Yeah, I mean, I had the suspicion in St. George. I biked quite poorly in St. George.
Yeah.
And I think I had the fastest run by about 2.5 minutes. And I had the suspicion that, I mean, he had said that he had run, you know, took it easy on the run and that sort of thing. But we biked very evenly, and I knew my power file was quite poor. It was very sloped downwards. In other words, I pushed a lot less power in the end than the beginning. And generally, if you bike like that and then you also run like that, that it means you were suffering on the run. It's not because you were running very controlled. Do you know what I mean? If you biked very controlled, then you would have held the same power from start to finish and then also, you know, ran fairly controlled as well and held it start to finish. So my theory was, well, I think he suffered a lot more in St. George on the run than he was giving credit to, and I was going to test that in Sammarin. And so I rode a lot better. I pushed about 20 watts more in Sammarin than I did in St. George, which over 70.3 is about 3 minutes. And on paper, it pretty much, you know, worked out to that as well. And so I wasn't that surprised, actually, because, I mean, you don't get something for nothing. If you bike really hard, it should have a very negative impact on your run. And, I mean, I've been biking hard and, you know, riding solo and running off of it for, you know, well,
your whole
my entire career
yeah,
now.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've really honed that ability, I think. So, I mean, I'm not going to say Alistair is not going to figure it out, because he's a great, great athlete, all-around athlete. It didn't surprise me that we took that time back. You know what I mean? It's really only his third 70.3. So, on the other hand, you know what I mean? I won't lie. I certainly had fear as we went by him because I knew how pissed off he probably is about it.
Yes.
And the training now that he is going to do to avenge that.
Yes. Yes.
You should be very afraid of, and I am. So, you know, I live for the next race.
So, speaking of that, the training that you did, I'm assuming going into St. George, knowing Alistair was coming there, you might have buried yourself a little too much in training, trying to make sure you could ride and run with this guy.
Yeah, I was very afraid. Hindsight's always 20/20, and it was dumb what I did after Oceanside. Pretty much right after Oceanside, the start list for St. George came out, and I saw his name on it, and I was like, "Oh crap!" I was afraid because you know I knew he has the ability to not. He certainly doesn't have a weakness, and I knew from stories I had heard that he was a very good biker, so I was worried that I wouldn't be able to make any time up, and you know it just would have been deficit would have been equal to the swim start to finish, and so I basically with that fear in my mind I went down into the basement and rode the bike harder than I've ever rode the bike. I posted the best 1 hour power I've ever posted by like 15 watts, and you know I did very good run workouts, very hard run workouts. Back to back, and it just you know it's all fine and dandy. I think you need to train hard, but I abandoned the plan that I and the way I had been training all season and the lessons I had learned the last several years. I abandoned them basically out of fear, and I just went back to my old overtraining habits, not recovering. I think I went into it, and it really showed itself both in the swim and then in the bike. I had literally it's the second worst power I have pushed in a professional 70.3, and it should have been the opposite. It should have been an opportunity to push the absolute best power I've ever pushed, I was very disappointed, but it was good. It's good that it happened because I learned the lesson there that needed to be learned, and then I got back on track, and then I was able to, I think, pull it together at the race in Slovakia.
Well, and you mentioned that you're about, 5K into the run in that race, and you're starting to have negative thoughts. You're starting to feel, okay, you know, second is okay, Sebi looks great. And I remember I was interviewing this coach, Fred LaPlante, who coached a great runner by the name of Monica Joyce, and Monica would say to him, you know, I look around, and these women look so great during the race. And he told her, said, Monica, if they're with you, they're hurting as bad as you are, right? So don't look at somebody and think, oh, my God, they look amazing. Because if they're running as fast as you are, they're hurting as bad as you are. Did you sort of learn that with this whole Sebi situation?
I mean, it's so difficult in the moment. Your brain has, like, almost no mental capacity whatsoever.
None.
It's
none.
Like, yeah. It's like I try and, like, do 2 + 2, literally, you know, doing a deficit or something. And it takes me 15 minutes to figure it out. And it's the same. There's just no rational thought. And, like, right from the get-go of that race, I think because of the fact that it was so flat and there was, like, no corners. There was, like, one turnaround, basically. And so no opportunity to get out of the time trial position. Like, it was a very difficult race. Like, literally 3 weeks later in Mont-Tremblant, I pushed pretty much the same power, and it felt, you know, 20 times easier because of the you know, the grade changes. You could get out of the saddle. You
different
could,
muscles.
You know, do different muscles, all that stuff. So the moment my feet hit the ground, I was like, oh, God, this is going to be a very painful experience today. And so, you know, when you start it already like that, it's not good. But I think it's a testament to, you know, focusing. I do a lot of my focus isn't so much on the physical component. It is the mental component. And so I think when you get that those habits into you and of pushing hard and continuing to persevere even when something's not going very well, it just becomes habit. And so yeah, I had these negative thoughts, but there's always like this third perspective behind it. And what's interesting is Sebastian would gap me, and you know, as we were running next to each other, I'd be like, oh God, it's over, second place is good, you know, this is one of the greatest athletes to ever do the sport, all this stuff. But then when I would be maybe 3 meters back, all of a sudden I would focus back on myself.
Yes.
And I would say, okay, hold on a second here. This isn't too bad. I'm getting my feel back. I'm getting my rhythm back. Okay, come on, bridge the gap. And then I would pull back up to him. And, I mean, I think the only reason I was able to do that, you know, you asked me to do that 2 years ago. I wouldn't have been able to do it. But I train that mental component so much now that it's like it's habitual. And it comes out, and really I live for that moment when everything is screaming, no, slow down, stop. I live for that moment. All the training really is for that moment to persevere onwards a few more steps.
Now, do you consider that, the race at Chamonix, do you consider that your best race now?
I mean, I consider it my best performance.
Yeah.
But my best race to this day, I still would say, is St. George 2014 because of the learning experiences that I had at it.
Yeah.
But from a performance, yeah, absolutely. It was a good... Oh. It was my best swim and a very good bike ride and then a great battle under. It was very hot out there.
Right.
And Sebastian's a proven heat runner, and I'm a proven poor heat runner. So it was good to execute under those conditions.
Now, that was your first challenge event, and it was at this ex-Bionic Sphere, which I've heard is spectacular. What are some of your feedback on the event itself?
The event was amazing. I mean, I'm super excited that they're going to return there for the next 3 years. I've never been to a facility like that. It was like, I mean, I could see myself actually going there and
for
staying
training.
There for a month and doing a training camp. It was so cool.
Yeah.
Especially as someone like myself who doesn't, I won't budge on the riding on the road thing anymore.
No, I don't blame
and,
you.
Yeah. And just for safety. And they literally have right on the Danube River, like thousands of kilometers of bike path, and it's not like this tiny little bike path. It's like it's basically a road.
Wow.
You know, beautiful surface. A lot of the race actually went onto it at one portion of the race, and so you can do all your biking there, and then of course you could use that to run then of course you could swim in the river, but at the facility they have a 50 meter outdoor pool, a 25 meter indoor pool. Outdoor running track, huge gym, lots of restaurants. You don't even have to leave if you don't want to. It was a fantastic training facility, and then the weather was great too. You know, pretty much every day it was nice and warm. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a fantastic event.
And they have a water slide park, which
of course
is essential.
Water slide park too. I mean, I wanted to do it actually, but the one day, the day after the race, it rained.
Oh.
And so I don't think they were opening it. So.
Next year. One of the other things that you did this year, which I thought was really fun, was, you know, I was surprised that you were running Boston Marathon. And you ran with your mom, who's overcome herself, right? She's overcome smoking and really became not just a runner, but a very talented age group runner. And you went out to Boston, and your mom was running, and you ran, and I think you qualified in Kona, if I'm not mistaken, like a couple years ago. So take me through that experience. How fun was that?
That was a really cool experience. It was fun, too. We still laugh about that. Was my mom's first ever interview with you, and we still laugh about that. If you go back and watch that video, she was, like, if you know her, she was so nervous. She was, like, white knuckling that microphone. One word answers, like, yes, 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 yes. And so we still make fun of her about it, and she's a good sport. She laughs, too.
Well, and the cool part was the protective side of you was obvious, right? You wanted to make sure that your mom felt, you know, you wanted, you're cracking jokes. You're like, hey, mom, this is fun. And she got into it after a while.
Yeah, everyone loosens up. I mean, it's not the first interview I had ever done.
No.
So,
yeah.
You get a lot better. You come to realize you just be yourself. That's how you do it. Yeah. And, but that's hard. You know what I mean? In the first few instances. So anyways, that was a fun experience right there. But the event itself was, I'd never been to a big city race, and the biggest race I'd ever been to is Kona. So,
yeah.
which is amazing and cool. But this was like next level, like
yes.
I've never experienced. I couldn't even believe it when we were walking through the corrals, how many people there were.
Yep.
It was unbelievable. Just how they can even organize that amount of people to do something and corral everyone and have it all go smoothly is absolutely amazing. So, and then the race itself was super cool. Mom and I started side by side, and then the whole intention, because I did have St. George coming up a couple weeks later, so I didn't want to run, you know, the whole thing with mom just because it would have been very taxing for me.
Yes.
So what I did is I did my long run for the first, I think I did 25K, and it just got me to like right about Heartbreak Hill. And so then I basically ate freezies for the next half an hour, maybe 10 freezies, because people are handing them out everywhere.
Yes.
And people are trying to hand you beers and stuff, too, but I didn't take any of
those. I had some
of
that. I had beer.
And I thought it was amazing, the crowds. This was like literally the entire 26 miles was people the entire way. It was so difficult, actually, to not, like, I just did my long run. It was so difficult not to just bang it out as hard as I could because you're just so motivated. And then anyways, I ended up catching up with my mom, and then we ran the final. I think at that point I was at about 32K. So we ran the final 20K together and, experienced the whole thing and went through the finish line. And it was when we came up, I forget what the name of it is, but it's the girls' school, I think. Boys' school, one of them.
Wellesley.
Yeah, it was amazing. You could hear them from like a mile away. It was like, what is that sound?
Yes.
And it was like a roar. And the whole thing, it was a great week. We went to a Boston Red Sox game. That was cool. We had a great time. The whole event was great. I definitely want to go back, except I want to run it full tilt one day.
Oh, you'd be great at that. Yeah,
that'd be fun.
I'm in my Elvis outfit running that race. And as we went through it, you saw it during Wellesley where all the girls are, you know, stop and kiss, right? So my wife is following me online, and my mile time through Wellesley was 37 minutes. She's like, what were you doing? I was like, well, you got to be there. You got to understand.
You got to enjoy it.
You got to enjoy every second. So now will you be up in Penticton? Is that next?
Yeah, I'm going to do that one next. I haven't done an ITU. I've done one ITU race. It was ITU Duathlon World Championship in 2011. So this will be my second time doing an ITU race. So I'm excited. It's in Canada. It's the first time they're doing a multi-sport festival. So that'll be cool to experience. And then I think I've never been to Penticton, so
you'll
love beautiful.
It. Yes.
So I'm excited for the whole thing. And then, of course, the distance is really cool, too. It's a 3K swim to a 120K bike to a 30K run. So it just makes a perfect tune-up for Kona to see, you know, where the training is, where the fitness is. And then, of course, the beauty of it is it's like right at that point where you're starting to do a little bit of damage at 30K into the run.
Yep.
And the race is over. So it's perfect.
I've always loved that distance. That sort of was the Nice distance back in the day,
mm-hmm.
And that was a great distance because it's more like a 6-hour day than an 8-hour day, and it's something you can race more often.
Yeah, it's a shame that the governing bodies don't, you know, chat with each other a little more and get these races better spread out. You know what I mean?
Yes,
so you got the big fields. I think Challenge, what they're doing, putting their 70.3 World Championship in June, I think is a fantastic idea. Because I mean, if you're preparing for Kona, I think the best way to prepare for Kona is to get in the absolute best 70.3 shape you can for like the first 6 months, and then the next 3 months you convert that speed over to endurance. And so I think it actually now, especially next year, now that they've sort of proven that they can, you know, execute a very good event, I think you'll see a lot more people, you know, cater their season to that event and then switch over to training to the Kona race. So anyways, I'd love to see, you know, this ITU distance be a little more successful but what are you going to do?
Well, and I love the fact that this is the first time, because it used to be ITU World's long course was in Oklahoma City, and then they had the duathlon somewhere else. And putting six world championships over 10 days gives, especially for the age groupers, they can come and do multiple events and, you know, basically pay one plane ticket and be able to
absolutely.
Do a few events. I think it's a great concept, and hopefully they'll do more.
Yeah, and hopefully there'll be a lot better turnout for these events, too.
Yes.
And you'll see a lot, you know, sometimes you see not too many people going, but I think this year will probably be the first year where they prove themselves, and then hopefully next year we'll see, you know, progressively bigger fields and everyone showing up who should be there.
So the couple years you've done Kona, 1 year you did, I think, 15 long brick workouts and felt you fried yourself. And then last year, focusing on 70.3, maybe not enough long workouts, but had the speed. You were perfect for basically the 70.3 distance.
Yeah, I did the best 4 hours in Kona of anyone.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The last few were a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
This year, what will the training be like getting into Kona?
I mean, I've already started my preparation right after Samarin. So, I mean, it's a blend of 2015 and 16. And what's funny, again, I sound like I'm saying the same thing over and over again, but Sebastian said to me one time, and he said it jokingly, so 1 year after 2015, I was at the Oakley house, and it was the first time I ever met him in real life, and as I was leaving, he yelled to me, "Hey, Lionel, stop doing an Ironman every day." And because he must have been following like my videos and stuff,
yeah.
And saw that literally that was the year I did the 15 literally
yes.
Ironman bike rides leading into the race at better than over 300 watts every single ride for over 4 hours, and then a sub 120 half marathon off each one of them. And then in 2016 I had the opposite experience where I did nothing long whatsoever, and at Island House he said to me, "Go back and read your blogs from 2015 and then read your blog after Kona in 2016. Take the middle of those two, and that's how you prepare for an Ironman." And so that's what I'm doing. I've blended the two. And so I'd say the biggest thing, though, that I've changed this year that I think is very, very useful and is applicable to anyone is I take the necessary recovery so that I'm not overtraining. So that after I do, this is the current block I'm using. I do 7 days of work, then I take 3 days, 1 day completely off, 2 of active recovery. And now that I'm getting into the really heavy lifting, I'm doing 7 days and then 4 days with 1 day off and 3 days of active recovery. So whereas in the past, I would literally do 21 straight days of hard work and maybe take 2 or 3 days easy and repeat that. And by the time you get to September and October, repeating that 6 or 7 times, you're completely fried. Whereas now I feel like a million bucks. I really have carried no fatigue throughout the season. So I'm excited to, you know, put it to work for the full distance.
Good for you, man. Hey, Lionel, as always, I love chatting with you. Love what you bring to the sport. You're a guy who's overcome a lot, and your enthusiasm for the sport, enthusiasm for, you know, for the age groupers and for just being out there and loving every second of what you're doing, that comes through loud and clear. And that's a message that that our listeners really appreciate.
Bob, it's always a pleasure.
Again, Lionel Sanders has been our guest. We are brought to you by ToughManTry.com, the Toughman Triathlon Series, VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, ATVSwimSpas.com, the official training vessel for 6-time Ironman World Champion Dave Scott, RunCatalina.com, Catalina Eco Marathon, Half Marathon Ted K coming up Saturday, November 18th, DonateCAF.com, our Challenge Athletes Foundation. We've sent out over 2,448 grants this year, totaling $3.7 million. To keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport, check us out on BabbittVille.com, on iTunes, and as always, endurance lives here.